This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. This March will mark a year since our region essentially shut down to stop the spread of the coronavirus. In a devastating domino effect, people lost their jobs, ran out of money, couldn't pay their rent or mortgages, and many also couldn't buy enough food. Today we're checking in with housing and food security advocates to find out how people are managing during this second wave of COVID-19. We talk first about food with Paul Pachter. He's the CEO of Long Island Cares, and he's on the phone with us. Welcome back to The Full Story, Mr. Pachter.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Could you remind us how Long Island Cares works? How do you reach people who need food?
Sure. Well, Long Island Cares, the Harry Chapin Regional Food Bank, provides emergency food assistance to more than 350 community-based organizations. Those would be the soup kitchens, the food pantries, the daycare centers, and others who assist those people who are struggling with food insecurity to put meals on their table. In addition to that, our organization operates five satellite centers throughout Nassau and Suffolk County, where we provide our own emergency triage pantries to people who are experiencing food insecurity for the very first time and don't know where to turn. And then we do a lot of community education and following the legacy of our founder, as you mentioned, Harry Chapin, we are very heavily involved in social justice activities and advocating for sound social policy that address things like poverty, hunger, racial injustice, et cetera. So that's what we do. We pride ourselves not only on being the regional food bank, but as a humanitarian organization as well.
My quick math, that's like 355 different locations where you're reaching out to make sure people have food.
That's correct, yeah.
We spoke to you back in July when the pandemic and the shutdown forced many people on Long Island to search for help in finding food for themselves and their families. And you said then that from March to the end of June, you had helped about 100,000 people, and about half of that number were people who had never fallen short of finding food before. I'm wondering, is this trend continuing through the second half of 2020?
Yes, absolutely. We actually ran the numbers yesterday. And so the number of people who have turned to Long Island Cares for the first time for food assistance due to the pandemic has increased to a little more than 163,000 now. And overall, people that are using Long Island Cares for assistance, not only the first time, but come to us regularly, that number is now up to about 230,000. So the problem persists, the numbers keep growing, and here we are, as you said, you know, almost a year into this. You know, it's 10 months now, but within the next 2 months, I don't see the numbers decreasing that much at all.
You know, we use numbers, and sometimes people kind of get lost in the midst of big numbers. These folks come from all walks of life, these folks who especially are for the first time looking for food?
Yes. These are people who come from all different walks of life, all different socioeconomic backgrounds. But what we do know is that at least 9 out of 10 of the new people who have visited our satellites or the temporary pop-up distribution centers that we operated in the town of Hempstead, 9 out of 10 people are coming to us because they have lost their jobs as a result of the pandemic. If you look at what has transpired on Long Island in the last 10 months, you're looking at major businesses, major employers, Pier 1, Century 21, Modell's, Regal Theaters. You know, people are just closing up shop, and that doesn't even count the small mom-and-pop businesses that had to close down that maybe just employed maybe 3 or 4 people. You look at a Pier 1 or a Modell's where they employ thousands of people. These people are out of work. Unemployment checks have stopped, and, you know, the third stimulus package took a little longer than we would all have hoped it would have taken to get out to people in need. But unless we get people back to work, this problem is going to continue, in our opinion.
Also back in July, you said that Long Island Cares was receiving enough in donations to meet the growing need. Is that still the case?
Yes. We've been very fortunate with people making donations to our organization. We've raised more than $500,000 of food through virtual food drives. Our retail donation program is extremely strong. The retailers have been, tremendous in terms of what they're donating to us. So, we're still confident that we have enough resources to carry us through the rest of 2021, if necessary.
Do you think the pandemic has changed the way people think about food security? I'm thinking about the folks who need the help and about those who make decisions when it comes to who should get the help and how they get it. People at the county and state levels when it comes to lawmaking.
The answer to that is absolutely. If you look at the profile of food banks across the country in the last 10 months, all you have to do is turn on your local news station to find a story about food lines or drive-through lines and other ways that people are distributing food. So I think the country and Long Island being part of that have a new appreciation for what food banks do and who they are. And I think, that's been the only, in my opinion, the only benefit that has come out of this very dark period in our history.
Planning for the future is something that your organization and others like yours have to do on an ongoing basis. I'm wondering, what's your outlook for 2021? Do you anticipate the need for your services will continue to grow?
We think the need is going to continue. Right now what we've seen is a 63% increase in food insecurity overall in Nassau and Suffolk County. We think those numbers will come down as more people slowly get back into the workforce, but not to the levels they were last year. I think they're going to stay pretty close to this number that we're looking at right now, which is about 480,000 Long Islanders. But, again, during the pandemic, we had to hire 30 temporary staff people because we opened up 18 distribution centers in the town of Hempstead. Those were closed at the end of the year, but we kept 10 of the staff on permanently. Our satellite locations, all five of them, plus our pet pantry, are continuing to open and be open, rather. We have a new super pantry, client choice pantry, in the village of Bethpage that we will keep open through the end of April at least. Our mobile outreach programs to veterans, to children, to the homeless and seniors are, still out there delivering meals to people's homes. So I think we'll continue to do what we're doing, and hopefully maybe mid-year, maybe by the time everyone or majority of the people are vaccinated, maybe we'll see the numbers change. But for right now, we anticipate them to continue.
If someone listening right now would like to volunteer, is moved to volunteer at one of your locations, is there a way for them to do that?
Yes, absolutely. We are still accepting small groups of volunteers at all our locations, including our warehouse in Hop Hog. And if people are interested in volunteering, they should log on to our website at licares.org, click on the volunteer link, fill out the form, and they'll hear from us very shortly, and we look forward to welcoming them.
And for folks who may be looking for help when it comes to finding food, how can they get in touch with Long Island Cares?
Well, they can get in touch with Long Island Cares by calling us at 631-582-FOOD, or also logging on to our website, clicking on our food locator button, and they can put in their zip code and find out all the pantries and the other emergency food programs in their local community.
Mr. Pachter, thank you so much for your time and sharing that information with us, updating us on the constant need for food. We appreciate that.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Paul Pachter is the CEO of Long Island Cares. It's been a roller coaster ride for renters and homeowners in our region since the pandemic began last March. Several times, moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures were extended to keep people who couldn't pay their rents and mortgages in their homes. Those grace periods were due to end in December, but they've been renewed one more time. In Connecticut, Governor Lamont set the new deadline for the moratorium on evictions for February 9th. In New York, Governor Cuomo has put COVID-19-related residential evictions and foreclosures on hold until May 1st. It's hard to know what this means for people on the verge of losing their homes. We've asked Ian Wilder, the executive director for Long Island Housing Services, to help us understand. His organization is a private, nonprofit, fair housing advocacy and enforcement agency which serves Suffolk and Nassau counties. And he joins us now on the phone. Mr. Wilder, welcome back to The Full Story.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Sure. Long Island Housing Services advocates for renters as well as homeowners. Is that correct?
Yes. We actually have two portions. Besides doing the fair housing enforcement work, we also do housing counseling work where we assist both renters and homeowners who are having financial difficulty.
And how do the moratoria work? Do they help, or are they just increasing the bill that renters and homeowners will ultimately have to pay down the road?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with them. They help, but they're also kicking the can down the road. I've been very angry, especially with the federal government, because we've had extensions of various moratoriums, because you mentioned the state ones, but there's also a patchwork of federal ones. And they've keep putting these moratoriums in place, at least often federally, without putting a solution at the end. As you mentioned, money is going to be owed, whether it's rent or mortgage, and that's not forgiven at the end of the moratorium. If I could, I mean, the focus I've had for people more is that they should use this time, individuals, renters and homeowners, to contact the housing counseling agency. I mean, we do that work. There's another dozen on Long Island. Mm-hmm. They're all over Connecticut, I believe, where you're based. If you just Google HUD housing counseling, it'll bring up a searchable map. You should talk to a housing counselor right now. They're certified by HUD. They're paid by grants, so they're free. And they can help you put a plan in place, because these moratorium will end, and it will be a huge problem.
So essentially, they'd be able to help, you say, put a plan in place. In other words, a payment plan moving forward?
Well, it really depends on particular circumstances. A payment plan is a possible option, especially for homeowners, because there are structures for modifications with the banks. With landlords, it's a little bit more difficult because there is no government regulation or structure requiring them to have a payment plan, but they can also help them look at their budget, see if there's places where they can put money aside, and make a plan for what happens at that point. A payment plan could be one possible option. The other reason, obviously, to talk to housing counselors is they are the people who keep on top of what funds are available. You know, on Long Island, Nassau County had opened up funds to help. It was a couple $1 million, but it ended up being 800, I believe, renters. The state had got some money, but not nearly enough from the federal government to help out renters. You know, as much as you can knock down of what's owed, it's helpful. I mean, the study showed when we got a real stimulus check the last time, when people got substantial funds, they did put that towards rent to pay back rent because they understand that it's going to come due.
You mentioned landlords. How has moratorium activity affected them? We talk a lot about the people who, you know, could lose homes or mm-hmm. or apartments and rental properties or rental homes due to a loss of job, a loss of income. Obviously, the domino effect is onto landlords. Mm-hmm. What effect has this had on them?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, landlords are in the same circumstance often that individual homeowners are. You know, they have to turn around and pay a mortgage. And especially if it's a small landlord, somebody who might own one unit, They depend on that rent to turn around and pay the mortgage on the property. So we have to look at the landlords as part of the ecosystem in terms of both dealing with the rent that has to be paid with the tenants, but making sure that, you know, the money that goes through also helps the landlords catch up. Like I said, you know, I've been on all ends of it. I've been doing this work for a while, and the whole structure in comparison for homeowners for modifications being done through the banks was a disaster. And I think it was actually more successful when they gave people the $1,200 payments and they directly paid their landlords. So I'm not sure if, you know, going back to Andrew Yang and the whole UBI, if the most successful way is to just get people money and they get it to the landlords, and that pays both the rent and helps the landlord pay the money they have outstanding.
You mentioned that in terms of the number of people who will run into a problem once the extended moratorium is ended, you described it as a potential tidal wave of homelessness, essentially, that could appear once the moratorium ends. Is Long Island, generally speaking, prepared to deal with that kind of a problem?
No, we're not. I mean, agencies like mine prepare as much as we can, but, you know, we only have so much funds in terms of people we can hire and work we can do. I mean, we are trying to expand a little bit to be prepared. But Long Island overall, no. And that's why I keep talking about the federal government, because the state and the counties here are in particularly bad shape because of this pandemic. Nassau and Suffolk County weren't in particularly good shape even before it, and the state was having some difficulties. They don't have the funds to actually put in the money. The federal government is the only one that can print money, and they can make a choice. They can print money by giving tax cuts to people who already have a great deal of money, or they can turn around and, you know, return the tax system to where it was, actually where it was when this country was most fruitful in the 1950s, and be able to cover the problems for, you know, the average taxpayer and keep the economy going. We literally have to make a choice. You know, people say a budget is a moral choice. We have to make those moral choices.
With the new Biden administration coming in, speaking of the federal government, yes, do you anticipate perhaps more financial help coming to New York than has been available under the current administration?
I anticipate more coordinated and national and successful solutions with the Biden administration. The outgoing administration, their handling of both the health aspect and the economic aspect by not doing planning has just been a disaster. If you look at Biden's experience, if you look at his experience as vice president, you know, outgoing as vice president, you know, he had experience dealing with the economic problems when he was in the Obama administration. They put out actual plans and people in place that were taken out to deal with this pandemic. So I am hopeful. Now, my biggest concern is that, you know, theoretically the Democrats control the Senate, but that control was by the slimmest majority with the vice president voting. And, I am concerned about them rallying the votes to do what's necessary to move our country forward.
I'm talking with Ian Wilder, the executive director for Long Island Housing Services. You've dealt with housing issues for quite some time, and I'm wondering, do you think this pandemic experience has transformed the way people think about housing, generally speaking?
I hope so. I hope so. We would have a greater economic engine if we looked at basic needs as something that just needs to be covered, so that it would free people up. the creativity and the imagination of the people who live in this country and come to this country is abundant, but a lot of it is just overtaxed by, you know, the daily fight for survival. So I am hoping that it's given us the ability to realize that we need to provide for the basics, for housing, for health care, so that people are free to contribute.
We've touched on this before, but just to reiterate, what should renters and homeowners be doing right now? What do they need to do now to prepare for that moratorium deadline?
I don't mind repeating this as often as possible. I realize it's giving them breathing space, and I realize that the pandemic also creates other challenges. I have a small child at home, and believe me, it creates challenges. But they need to take advantage of this breathing space to put a plan in place, because when the moratorium ends, and if there is no action being taken on a federal level that's going to take care of all their back rent, or even for homeowners, all their back mortgage, and I don't see that happening at the moment, they need to have a personal plan in place. They need to reach out to a HUD-certified housing counselor in their area. If they just Google that, it'll take them to the HUD website and they can look it up. They're free because they're paid for by grants. They're on top of all the resources that are available, both in terms of other moratorium that might help, such as for federal government paid for properties or insured properties, and for resources that might be available to help them pay the rent. So they should take advantage of those resources now rather than when they're under pressure and have no time because they've been served with a court date. And I can't speak for Connecticut, but in New York, you're basically in court the next week when you get served. Landlord-tenant proceedings are unlike almost any other court proceedings. They happen very, very fast. I used to practice in landlord-tenant court. I'm very aware of it. People really, really need to take advantage of these circumstances. They can reach out to us if they want, if they're in Nassau, Suffolk. Our website is LI, as in Long Island, fairhousing.org. That's lifairhousing.org. If you want, you can email me directly at info@lifairhousing.org, or you can call. Our phone number is 631-567-5111. My personal extension is 314, so that's 631-567-5111, extension 314, and we cover Nassau and Suffolk counties. But just like I said, if you're outside of those areas, there's people that do the same things in your areas, and you don't even have to call us. There's a dozen other excellent agencies, even in Nassau and Suffolk counties, who do the same work. Just go out and get the help now. Put together a plan before, as we said, the tidal wave hits, when it's too late.
Mr. Wilder, thank you so much for your insights and for that very important contact information. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ian Wilder is the Executive Director for Long Island Housing Services. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Marginalized communities on Long Island have been hit particularly hard by COVID-19. Immigrants, documented and undocumented, minorities, the elderly and low-income residents often have limited resources, even when the economy is robust. When the pandemic caused the shutdown last March, Organización Latino Americana of Eastern Long Island, or OLA, refocused its efforts to support these communities. Minerva Perez is the executive director, and she joins us on the phone. Ms. Perez, good to speak with you again.
Nice to speak with you as well, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Could you remind us about the services that OLA offers?
Sure. Well, during the pandemic, a lot of our focus now has been related to food crisis, related to helping people through illegal evictions and lockouts, helping people to access mental health support, and also health care and basic transportation needs as well. So this is a lot of what we're focusing on at the moment. Generally, our work is centered in areas of advocacy in terms of systemic concerns that we might have, or just better way to connect people to what exists already out here in terms of access to law enforcement or healthcare or education. But right now, a lot of our focus is related to this pandemic.
Well, it's been about 6 months since we last spoke, I believe, in July. At this point, as this new year gets underway, what are you hearing from people about what they need most right now?
What they need most right now is to know that they're not going to be taken out of their homes. And even though we do have this eviction moratorium that's going to go until May 1st, which is wonderful that the governor signed that, the unfortunate situation is that people are so far behind in rent as it relates to their loss of job and illness because of COVID that it could still be that they end up having a money judgment against them, which will follow them, which will impact their lives greatly as well. So we're hoping that May 1st that we can see some additional relief for families, including families that are not documented. We have families of mixed status individuals, so we have children that are going to be bearing the brunt of what might happen when this, as soon as evictions are possible. We're also very concerned about homeowners and landlords. There is a forbearance act that has been signed so that there are 180-day forbearance possible relief options as well that also stop any kind of lender from putting out a negative credit report. We just want to make sure that all of our landlords and our renters are getting whatever support they can have so that we don't see massive sort of influx of people to homeless shelters in the middle of a pandemic.
And I just want to remind folks who are listening that that May 1st moratorium date is for New York, not Connecticut. It's a New York date. One major concern has been people in need having access to food, with many folks living, pretty far from food pantries. Has this situation improved at all?
I would say not, and not because the pantries aren't trying their best, and not because organizations out here anyway, like Long Island Harvest and Island Care, Long Island Cares and Island Harvest, aren't doing tremendous work to get food to the pantries. The need is just that much more. And during in our area, it's a very seasonal place, so employment plummets anyway during the winter season, and people did not even make enough money during the summer season to get them through the winter. So accessing these pantries is even more needed than before. And what we're seeing also is a lot of sickness as related to COVID, a lot of people in quarantine. I'm looking at some of the roles that we have, some of the families that we have on our food crisis list, which include families of 10, families where there are three adult children, all with mental and physical disabilities, no way to get around, no way to get food, no way to get to the pantry. So we are lucky to still have volunteers and new volunteers working with us to do the food shopping, get it to the families themselves, and that's how some of these families are even getting food. We have some food cards that we're giving out to families to supplement those who can drive but are not getting enough from the pantries. We're able to give them some food cards so they can get milk and meats and produce. We're working with some local farms to make sure that there's as much access as we can connect up with local farms and produce for our community members that need it most. So there's a lot that's happening in that regard, and it's not diminishing at the moment.
I was going to say, thinking back to when we spoke in July, it sounds like the situation really has not improved a whole lot for the folks living in the communities that you serve.
What I think has improved is the support from fellow community members, so houses of faith, individuals that are stepping up to do this volunteer work. It's very much a relay race in that, you can do as much as you can, then you got to hand that baton off, and volunteers are doing just that. So we even still have volunteers that are willing to drive people to and from doctor's appointments. So we work a lot with cancer patients and our local cancer treatment centers, and there is not an easy way to get a cancer patient to and from a treatment. So, we have volunteers that we rely on for that. We're trying to keep people safe. We're right now getting ready to hire someone. We want to bring someone on that's already had the vaccine so we can feel comfortable with them using our vehicle and keeping themselves safe and having a protocol to drive people to and from doctor's appointments as we possibly can manage.
Yeah, generally speaking, access to health services, has that improved at all since July?
There have been some breakout bright spots where Ola was able to work with the county, Suffolk County, to bring out a mobile unit for testing, COVID testing, out to an area of Springs, East Hampton, that sees a lot of people that don't have an easy way out. They don't have an easy way to transport themselves out and around, and so we were able to bring that unit there. We would like to see more of that, but also have that be sort of a dry run for how we roll out vaccines. I do believe that East Hampton Town is already working on a rollout with a local doctor's office, Dr. Dempsey's office. We've got some other, Northwell Health is doing a lot. We're on some of the health equity task forces that Suffolk County and the state and the governor's office are putting together. We are very concerned about rollout of the vaccine, as we also want to encourage people to be testing and staying home and quarantining, but it's very hard if you don't have food. It's very hard if you think you're going to be homeless. So there are a lot of forces that are pushing against sort of what you want to see people do, which is stay home, get support, get through this COVID crisis. It's hard to tell people that when they're really worried about the very next moment of having a home or not. Mental health, we are doing a lot of work in the area of mental and emotional health access for adults and for adolescents. There's a lot of work we're doing in that area. I did want to share with you a very bright moment is that Ola has taken on Project Hope Coping with COVID grant that is going to allow us to have a number of crisis counselors, about 16. We've already hired 15 of them to be able to be there for folks to call in, talk with them, be listened to, and also get some great referrals both on the North Fork, South Fork, Riverhead, Shelter Island, so the whole east end of Long Island. And may I give that number?
Sure, please do.
That number is 631-500-0837. And we have three languages that are immediately accessible, Spanish, English, and Portuguese. And we've got a range of wonderful folks doing this work. So you can also go to the OLA website, olaofeasternlongisland.org, and look at the Project Hope list of all the crisis counselors with their different backgrounds. And again, this is a way to make sure that our fellow community members know that there's someone to reach out to and that's going to be some great referrals, and we're working to strengthen all the pieces that are missing, all the gaps that we're seeing related to food, related to eviction moratoriums and illegal lockouts. There are some people that are still going through illegal lockout situations, and we are right there at the forefront of making sure that law enforcement is involved, any kind of local legislator is involved, to make sure that those things don't happen.
Is the pandemic causing more concern about deportation of people who don't have documentation?
Folks are concerned about that because they giving over all that information about where they might be living or what concerns they might have. I mean, we're just trying to get out of what has been a nightmare of worrying about things like public charge. You know, if I access that particular kind of benefit or support, will that then ruin my chances as a green card applicant? So we've got a lot of fear there. We've got some DACA recipients that still haven't been renewed yet. So in terms of how far they can come out and talk about some of the needs that they have, it's still there. It's still in the air. The fear of that still stops people from accessing certain services and needed life-saving protections.
Ms. Perez, thank you so much again for your time and information, and we'd like to check in with you again in the not-too-distant future to see how things are going, especially with the rollout of the vaccine on Eastern Long Island.
Thank you, Tom. I'll be looking forward to that.
Minerva Perez is the Executive Director of Organización Latino Americana of Eastern Long Island, or OLA. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Let's talk now about the moratoriums in Connecticut. With me now on the phone is Erin Kempel. She's the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. Ms. Kempel, hello and welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. How does the Connecticut Fair Housing Center help renters and homeowners?
So the easy answer is that we help homeowners who are in foreclosure. We've been representing homeowners in foreclosure since the real estate market crashed in 2008. And while most people think that that ended in Connecticut, it has not ended. And in fact, Connecticut is fifth in the country for the number of homeowners who are delinquent on their mortgages. With regards to evictions, we are looking at the the systems that are resulting in tenants losing their homes. So we're trying to determine if there are better court systems, if there are better rental assistance programs, if there are ways to assist tenants that will result in them being able to keep their homes. Because what we know is that when a tenant is evicted, the likelihood of that tenant being exposed to COVID-19 or resulting in exposing others to COVID-19 goes up dramatically.
Is it fair to assume that you're quite busy now during the pandemic, both in terms of renters facing eviction and homeowners possibly facing foreclosure?
Yes. In fact, the calls to our office has almost tripled over this time last year. We are still getting calls from people who may have been the victim of housing discrimination when they're trying to move or when they're trying to stay in their homes. But the number of calls from tenants being evicted and from homeowners in foreclosure has also shot up dramatically.
Do you know offhand in terms of raw numbers what that figure is?
So what we know is that since the start of the pandemic, and on March 10th, the governor declared state of emergency. Since that time, landlords have filed more than 6,000 new eviction cases. So one of the things that I continue to hear from landlords and from social service agencies is that we're looking forward to eviction tsunami. In fact, we're already in the midst of that eviction tsunami. Tenants are being moved out and tenants are being evicted, not at the same rate they were a year ago, but still at a very high rate.
In December, the PBS NewsHour featured a report. You mentioned a tsunami of evictions. They featured a report on what they described as an impending tsunami of evictions in Fairfield County, or in Fairfield specifically, due to the pandemic. Is that still true? And is that description applicable to other areas around Connecticut?
Yes. One of the things that we're particularly concerned about in Fairfield County is that landlords may believe that if they evict a non-paying tenant now, they will be able to replace that tenant with someone from New York or from some other state who can afford to pay the rent. And while that may be true in some instances, we're not sure that it's true 100%, and it also doesn't really address the public health emergency that we're in, because as I said, every time someone is evicted, the chance of them either being exposed to the virus or exposing someone else to the virus goes up dramatically.
Back in July, Connecticut launched a program to help renters, specifically the Temporary Housing Assistance Program, offering up to $4,000, I believe, in assistance to low-income renters who might have been impacted financially by COVID-19. And I believe the state used about $40 million from the federal stimulus package to fund that. Could you explain how the program works and if it's helped many people?
Unfortunately, the program is now closed. It closed on December 3rd, and we do not expect it to open again. However, the state is expected to receive $237 million for a new rental assistance program. What we know about the TRAP program that ended in December is that in the first 3 months of its existence, it only assisted two households.
I'm sorry.
By the end of December...
I'm sorry, you said two?
It only assisted...
Wow.
Two. Yes. Yes.
And
the program then closed.
Why so few people being helped through that program?
What we heard from the people who were working to qualify people for the program is that the program was very cumbersome. It required a lot of documentation that tenants were having difficulty getting. It required a lot of cooperation by landlords, which was also slowing down the process. We believe that there were technical problems. So one of the things we heard is that housing counselors who are helping tenants upload documents and give documents to the Department of Housing in order to be able to qualify for the program, the housing counselors were only able to access that program once a week for a couple of hours. So instead of having sort of rolling applications and application verification, things were really, really slow in getting started. We understand that that sped up in September, but at the same time, my understanding is that of the $40 million that was originally allocated, the state only actually spent $25 million. That left at least 2,600 households, if not more, who had pre-qualified for the program without any assistance. It is hoped that that 2,600 will be able to qualify for the new program, that $237 million that was just allocated, but it, yet the Department of Housing is still creating the new program, and we don't know exactly how that will work.
Is it safe to assume that the problems that hampered that earlier program have been dealt with when it comes to the new influx of money?
I don't know. I mean, as I said, some of the issues were technical. Mm. For instance, one of the things that was very difficult is that the program closed at the end of August and then didn't reopen until mid-October. Until it reopened in mid-October, there was no online application that tenants could access. Once it reopened in October, tenants could access the online application, but there was no way to fill out the application in Spanish. We still don't know if that issue has been resolved and will be resolved under the new program. What DOH is hoping is that the new program will be more automated and less make it much easier for people to access. But then that gets into an issue with the digital divide, where if people are being required to upload things like a tax return from 2019 or pay stubs, while they may be able to do the application online, they aren't going to be able to upload those things through an iPhone or through some other use of a phone. And most people who are low income don't necessarily have access to full-fledged PCs where they can upload information.
Connecticut has a pretty long history of fair housing issues, especially in Fairfield County. Do you think the pandemic has changed how people view fair housing in the state?
I'm not sure that it has. One of the things with regards to evictions is I think it is much more widespread now than it was. Certainly a lot of people lost their housing or lost their jobs, and as a result of that are in danger of losing their housing. But at the same time, what we're seeing is a very large divide between people of color and people who are white in their ability to stay housed. One of the things we that even when someone who is white is loses their job, it is more likely that that person has assets or other resources that they can tap into to pay the rent, whereas that's not true of people of color. So if a person who was, for instance, working in New York or working at a job where they were salaried, they may have a savings account or an IRA that they can tap into, but people of color rarely have that.
Ms. Kemple, thanks for taking time with us today. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Erin Kemple is Executive Director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. Once the moratoriums end, thousands of people in Connecticut may have to deal with the eviction process. Rafi Podolsky is an attorney and public policy advocate with Connecticut Legal Services. He works with people going through that process. Benny joins me now on the phone. Counselor Podolsky, hello and welcome to The Full Story.
Hello. I'm very glad to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks very much for taking the time today. First of all, could you tell us, how does the eviction process work in Connecticut? Is that too broad of a question?
No. The eviction process is a court-based process. A landlord is not allowed in Connecticut or in most states to use self-help. You can't lock somebody out. You have to go through the court system, and it involves a series of steps that begins with kind of a warning notice called a notice to quit, which is a pre-court paper, and then ultimately followed by the bringing of a court action. which will lead in due course to a case being heard, either ideally mediated and hopefully an agreement worked out, or if necessary, going to trial. If a judgment is entered against the tenant, then the tenant could be evicted. Right now, for many forms of eviction, there's a moratorium in place, and that has really been critical to preventing literally thousands of evictions from having occurred during the pandemic. So the maintenance of an eviction moratorium has been very, very important, and really as a public health measure to prevent the kind of potential spread of disease that happens when people are forced out and end up doubling up or ending up in shelters, which then compounds the very health-related problems that the pandemic is producing.
And just one other question about the process itself. Is there a typical length of time that it takes from the beginning of an action to a resolution, one way or the other?
Well, and under the normal functioning of the system, the pre-pandemic form functioning of the system, from the time the case actually gets into court to the time a judgment is entered, was the median case was a little bit under 1 month, something around, I believe, around 26 or 27 days. The pandemic has obviously impacted that in a number of ways, but that's sort of been the kind of the historic pattern. A lot depends on whether the tenant appears in the case, that's to say shows up to defend, whether resolutions can be worked out quickly or whether a case goes to trial. There are things that will make a case take longer or shorter than the median. A lot of that is in the process of changing. The fact that there's been a moratorium has kept the courts from being overwhelmed with cases. The courts inherently will move slower when more cases start coming in because of the need to socially distance. It's required physical changes in courtrooms and court locations, or not locations, but in courtrooms, because typically in the pre-pandemic days, the courthouse would be crowded with people jammed into courtrooms or jammed in the hallways waiting for their case to be called. Excuse me, and for public health reasons, you really can't have that happening.
Now, you said many thousands of residents may be facing eviction once the moratorium is over, or more than one moratorium, I guess, between federal and state. Is the system really, the court system really prepared to handle so many cases? You said it definitely slows down, but with that kind of a sudden, almost tidal wave, is the system really up to speed to handle that?
Well, I don't think it's a question of the system being up to speed. You can't really handle that. There are roughly around 20,000 eviction cases brought a year in Connecticut. That's sort of been the historic number of evictions. And obviously there's a backup to some extent. And the combined with the limitations on how many cases you can handle at once, which are really caused by the pandemic, I don't think the system can comfortably move these cases with any degree of speed. It's one of the reasons why a rental assistance program is so absolutely critically important, because what's driven the situation has really been the economic consequence of the pandemic, which is people have lost their jobs. The income flow to tenants, which is what allows them to pay the rent, has been, for many, many tenants, especially lower income ones, has been kind of broken. And as a result of that, you end up with people being unable to pay the rent. And the federal government, as part of what I guess is be sort of the most recent round of an effort to deal with the coronavirus crisis, the federal government has authorized a large rental assistance program. There's going to be approximately $237 million coming into Connecticut to be used for rental assistance. And that creates a situation in which the landlords can get paid, and so that they are not bearing the full brunt of the situation. And at the same time, a moratorium, an eviction moratorium, could be maintained. And to me, that's sort of the win-win situation here, which we're finally reaching a point that there's probably not sufficient money, but at least a substantial amount of money that can do that, so that you can get an outside source essentially to be bringing down arrearages at the same time you're preventing people from being thrown out on the street. And that's actually a real, I mean, that's the newest, most positive development that has happened, and that I think is cause for a lot of hope. The state was trying to run its own program for which the state had put in about $40 million, but plainly that was not enough. That program's been closed because it was oversubscribed almost immediately, and so this is sort of the biggest step forward, is the availability that we're going to have of a rental assistance program.
Do you think the pandemic could change the way Connecticut deals with affordable housing?
I'm not sure what you mean by that question. I don't know that the pandemic changes. I don't know. Probably not in any real sense. I think it does change the way in which a lot of systems operate. And in the context that you've asked me about, which is evictions, the pandemic has really changed a lot in the court system already, because the courts have been moving for the purposes of the pandemic into a system in which things are being done remotely, and the kind of virtual hearing of cases. Mm-hmm. And that creates a whole new set of problems for people of low income, probably disproportionately people of color, because there's really a digital divide, people have different degrees of access to and knowledge of computer-related systems. They have different levels of equipment. If you're being heard, for example, if you're going to have a trial in court, it makes a big difference whether you have an adequate system for participating remotely or an inadequate system, whether you're trying to do it on a cell phone rather than a computer, whether you have a decent Wi-Fi connection or don't. All those things make a big difference, and we know that there are major differences based on income, race, based on age, actually, as well, which is another important divider as to who is best able to function in those kind of systems. In the way the courts are operating now, we've had issues with people who are unable to get into a hearing they're supposed to be at because they can't quite figure out how to get through to a Microsoft Teams entry points, or to stay on, or to their call gets dropped. I mean, those kind of problems are most significant for people who kind of have the least resources and least knowledge of how to make those systems work. So that's a change, and we don't know to what extent that change is going to be permanent. So to what extent things in that sense, it's not all that different from employment issues. As people have started to work from home, when the pandemic's over, we don't know whether everybody comes back to their places of work, or whether employers make the decision that, well, we can work out fine with people working remotely, and that may affect availability of jobs. The court system has the same kind of issues. To what extent will the court system, on a long-term basis, start to operate with people not coming into the building, with you know, the judges not actually having people in front of them? Our hope is that we're going to get back for most cases to the old system, but it's not clear that in fact is what's going to happen. I think we just don't know at this point.
For people who know or perhaps think they may be facing eviction once the moratoriums are ended, is there anything they should be doing or thinking about doing now to prepare for that eventuality?
I mean, what I would normally tell people who are at risk of eviction is the first step is always try to work something out. For a tenant, you want to be in touch with the landlord. It makes a difference down the road as to what's going to happen, whether you're sort of working all along with the landlord, letting the landlord know what the situation is like, trying to make some partial payments if that's workable. Because in the long run, it'll affect the landlord's willingness to work with somebody who's still behind in the rent. Again, with the right kind of rental assistance programs, we're able to clear many of those arrearages, and people at some level would be able after the pandemic to start with a clean slate or something pretty close to a clean slate. But I think it really does make a difference. So that to me is kind of the first piece of advice, is to sort of try and maintain a working relationship with the landlord. And I know it can be very awkward for people because if you don't have the money to pay the rent, you don't really have spare money even to make partial payments, it doesn't feel good. It can feel kind of humiliating. Mm. But I think it makes a difference. One of the things that I think people are looking at is the imbalance in terms of the kind of representation people have. If we reach a point where evictions are actively starting up in larger and larger numbers, the reality is the tenants need to have access to an attorney. The court system can certainly work with self-represented people, but attorneys will put a tenant in a much better position to explain their situation to a judge. And right now, the data is that roughly 80% of landlords who bring evictions have an attorney, and roughly 10% of tenants who defend evictions have an attorney, or tenants who are the defendants in evictions have an attorney. And that's a very real imbalance in terms of the ability just to work through the system and make sure that the court understands where things are. Do you have a defense? If you don't have a defense, what are your circumstances, and what's your capacity to move? All those things make a difference. And so there's actually been talk about, there have been some recommendations for funding of programs so that tenants who are indigent would be able to get an attorney in an eviction case.
I was going to say, is that the kind of program or perhaps legislation that Connecticut Legal Services would be working on to establish things like that to help those 90% of people facing eviction who just don't have access to an attorney?
Yeah, we absolutely would support something like that. And I think there are people. At various times, the Connecticut Bar Association has recommended that program of that sort be explored. So I think there's kind of a broad base of entities that would like to see that happen. We certainly support that, and that would be of tremendous benefits to tenants who end up facing eviction. But in some sense, the real goal is to minimize the need for the number of evictions. By kind of devising pre-eviction ways to reduce the pressure. It allows the court system to function in a more normal way because it reduces the number of cases. And it actually helps both landlords and tenants. I mean, it's not in anybody's real interest to have to bring evictions. And to the extent that housing stability can be maintained and these things can be worked out, it's sort of a win-win. It's beneficial to everybody, I think.
Counselor, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate your insights into this situation.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Raffi Podolsky is an attorney and public policy advocate with Connecticut Legal Services. And that's it for our program today. Produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Dan Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.